people, I'll tell you. Okay, let's talk about this book of short stories.
Okay.
Pretty hair-raising stuff.
Scary stuff, yeah.
Scary stuff, yeah. So I'm not going to ask you the autobiographical question, but it is sort of from your neck of the woods, and it is sort of the kind of people you grew up with, the new kind of, sort of.
Yeah, it's right out of the life, I'm afraid. It's all about those little northern mill towns and small company towns that I lived with, that I lived in and worked in, you know, between this, you know, between 56 and 64, you know. And it was hell. It was awful. I mean, they're just monstrous. They're monstrously awful places. They're just, I've never lived in a world that was so hopeless and depressing as that. And that's probably one of the reasons why I couldn't write about it. Because I just thought, you know, does the world need this story about all these people?
You know, but what made you think that the world did need?
I think I needed it.
Mm-hmm.
I think I needed to write it out. I think I needed to pour it out of myself and get rid of it once and for all. I mean, that sounds like kind of cheap psychology, but I think somewhere the stories just said to me, you know, tell me, tell me. And so I started to do it.
How did you come to leave it? Because when you're in this, in the lives that you describe, which is, you know, never have enough money to really get out of there, don't have any education to get out of there, living in a trailer, ice inside the windows, three kids, everybody pregnant all the time, can't see your way out of anything. Why did you?
Why did I what?
Get out of there.
Why did I get out? I got out because I think I would have killed myself if I hadn't have. I mean, I actually did. I tried to commit suicide at one point.
Mm-hmm.
I did. I put a rifle to my mouth and damn near blew my head off. And I suddenly put the rifle down and I suddenly said, Patrick, you got to get out. And I did. As a matter of fact, at that time, my brother Red was still living, and he was in Vancouver. And he'd met George Bowering, and he was beginning to write. And he'd written me a letter, and I thought to myself, because I was writing at that time, that was one of the things that sort of kept me alive in those little northern towns. I couldn't wait to get to the coast. And the other thing was Earl Burney wrote me a letter. Good old Earl. Yeah, I sent him a poem, and he wrote back this wonderful letter and said he just loved the poem. And I was, of course, astonished that he was even alive. I didn't even know he was alive, and this is years ago. But I thought all poets were dead, so, you know, sure.
Well, you didn't grow up in a family of poets either, did you?
No, although as it turned out, my brother Red was a poet.
Yeah.
My brother Johnny has written poetry, wrote a novel, you know.
You're the youngest?
Of the three of us, yeah, the first three kids who were born before the war. I was the youngest, yeah. I was the little spoiled one. Yeah.
Are you still?
Yep.
Here, in 1 second, we're talking about you having a rifle in your mouth, and the next minute, we're laughing and yucking it up about what a spoiled baby you were. Let's talk about the first story in this series, Mill Cry. You know, sometimes you read things and you want to be in them. You want to try and be part of it. Not just glorious stories and so on, but this one, although I was never in it, I felt as if I never wanted to live this. I never wanted to be in there. There's nothing in there that makes me think for 1 minute that I would like to experience this life that these people are going through.
Yeah, the people in the story are absolutely without hope of any kind. They are completely beaten to nothing, and there's going to be no escape for them. They're just going to go lower and lower and lower. And, you know, this is one of the things that struck me when I lived up there was that it was full of people like that, and they were beaten, hopeless people. And out of that beatenness and out of that hopelessness comes the most incredible violence and the forms of evil that are terrible, because they turn on themselves. They either turn on their wives. If it's a man, he turns on his wife and his children. Or the wife turns on the man or her children. I mean, the kind of hell that gets created out of that world is awful to behold. And people there have no idea of an outside world. They don't even know there is one. When I live in a little town...
Maybe you don't want to know there is one.
No. I mean, we couldn't even get radio then.
Right.
You know, there was no telephone. There was no TV. TV hadn't even been invented. You know, well, it had just been invented, but we didn't know about that. So... we didn't know anything. And because you're so isolated, you don't even know there's a way out of that world. I mean, things like, ideas like Toronto or New York or Paris become fantasies, you know, illusions, where you think that that world isn't out there at all. It's all a big lie. The only reality is inside, you know, the hell of that small sawmill town with that small, horrible trailer, you know, with the cold and the awfulness.
On Saturday night.
Yeah, you get your check at the end of the month, and I would buy a half a case of beer. And that would be it for the month. And I couldn't afford that half case of beer. I mean, that was big money. That was about $1.75 in those days, or $2.75 or something like that for half case of beer.
Mm-hmm.
I would buy that, and then my wife and I would sit and we'd drink all six bottles as fast as we could and pretend we were drunk, and that would be it for 30 more days until we could buy the next half case of beer. I mean, as an example of, and not because we were alcoholic, how could you be alcoholic in a half case of beer a month, but it was the only possible sort of diverting pleasure that you could possibly have, you know, other than sex and other than, you know, other than what?
Sex gets less diverting as you keep reproducing.
Yeah,
and having
that's right.
Like cordwood in the corner, the children.
That's right, pre-pill, right?
Yeah, pre-pill.
Yeah, it was an interesting life, all right.
You were the
terrible
first aid guy.
I was the first aid man, yeah.
Which is an exalted position, after all. You weren't working in the mill.
Well, I was a doctor in this little town. Mm-hmm. You know, the health nurse used to come through this little town, once every two or three months, and she'd look at kids, you know, shake her head and give them some pills, you know. The guy who had the local store used to sell these poor people what he called penicillin, and all it was just yellow candy. He used to charge him an arm and a leg for it.
Mm.
He was a real son of a bitch. He was an awful man. Hated him. He was really terrible. And here I was, this kid who got out of high school and took a six-week course in first aid. I was suddenly an industrial first aid man, thrown into a little tiny town up north, and I was a doctor.
Guys with bits of their body gone.
Yeah. What was funny about being a first aid man was I had kind of special status, and I was allowed into places where no one else was allowed in because of what I could do, theoretically what I was supposed to be able to do. You know,
couldn't
help people,
much.
Fix people, and that sort of thing. They'd allow me in to see things that nobody else in town was ever allowed to see. So I was given, it was a tremendous act of privilege. I delivered a baby up there. That was really funny. I mean, it was really funny. I mean, I did not know. My first aid course gave me it was a half a page on childbirth. How to deliver babies.
Mm-hmm.
And there I remember sitting there reading this half page. There was about, you know, maybe a paragraph. That was it. You know, what to do? Meanwhile, the woman was very busy, you know, continuing on with her life, giving birth to this child. It was her sixth
child. Reading the book.
Well, I'm reading the book, Desperately Boiling Water.
Tab A, slot B. Good God. All right, why don't you read something from Milk Cry?
I'll read something from Milk Cry.
Why don't you just read something from Milk Cry? You could start there.
I could just start, like, on page 5.
Okay.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Pump.
Do you know where to start?
Yeah. This is a couple in a small trailer in the middle of this mill town we've been talking about. And the woman's going to bed. She pulls on a heavy flannel gown and steps to the bed. It's cold at the back of the trailer. The heat doesn't reach here, and the walls are covered with thin sheets of ice. It's been weeks since the windows were clear. The bed is piled with blankets and towels and coats. She gets in and lies for a moment under the heavy covers and then rolls to her side. Down the hall, through the thin doors, she hears her husband come in, the front door banging shut, his boots falling to the floor, and in the long moment of quiet before a match is struck. Silence. He will come to bed eventually. She closes her eyes and falls instantly into deep sleep, her mouth sagging, her breath heavy and thick. The man sits at the table staring at the cigarette he's rolled. Like the boy earlier in the evening, he watches the smoke rise and flatten against the air. The afternoon shift is almost over. After the last whistle, he will go to bed. The graveyard shift will start up after cleanup. If there's an accident, someone will come to wake him. If there's no trouble, he will sleep as he always does, fitfully, turning and moving beside his wife's slack body. He follows the blue spiral up to where it stops, and then he takes a deep drag and blows a ring into the quiet. It moves away from him, a sluggish hole that falls to the table and changes shape, becoming a thin stream that tries to find a place to fall from, an edge, somewhere to go other than the surface it's trapped on. He waits, and when the shutdown whistle blows, he snubs the end off his cigarette with his thumbnail and puts the butt beside the ashtray. There's only a bit of tobacco left in the can, and payday is until Friday. Everything has to be saved. There's no waste in this world, only a watchfulness, a husbanding of things around him. He thinks he could go to his wife and wake her. They could talk, but about what? Talking is the most dangerous thing they can do. All their words are traps. Talk turns from the moment, the children's day, an owl scene or a bear, into other things, the maybe, the what if, or worse, the how and why. It's a place they no longer go. It leads to tears and argument, and if it goes far enough, to the other silence, the cold one he moves into. To go anywhere else is to release a violence waiting just beyond his life. He can't go there. He can't risk that. The last time they tried to talk was a week ago. After the yelling and screaming, he had stood in the center of the room as she flailed him with her hands. She had slapped him across the face until, weeping with rage and frustration, her arms grew tired and she could no longer lift them. He stood there, eyes closed, waiting for her to finish, a familiar numbness in his body, barely hearing his flesh turn into sound, feeling the blood in his mouth where his teeth had torn his lips and the inside of his cheeks, the way the blood tasted thick on his tongue.
That is from the first story in Patrick Lane's new book of short stories and prose, How Do You Spell Beautiful? Oh, dear. You know, the males in this story are all, the females, too, are beaten down, but the males are so really just relentlessly soul-destroying. And one of the guys from Mary Lou Had Her Teeth Out, which won some sort of place in an American anthology of short stories.
It was picked as one of the stories, best American stories.
That kind of guy, like the guy that traps his wife in the trailer and says, you can't come out. This is a father of an enormous number of children in the next mm-hmm. story. And he is an absolute tiny despot in his own little country of 16 people.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the story that absolutely sent me reeling. I don't know why. Because I knew a girl once that had all her teeth pulled out when she was 14 years old. All of them.
Well, that story, although I tell it from the point of view of an old sort of busybody man,
yeah,
who's the kind of the watcher of the village of the little town. He sees everything and knows everything and doesn't do anything, you know. He's just, and he's telling the story from his point of view. And there's a first aid man. And the story is as close to truth as I can imagine. I remember being that first aid man, and I remember that little, awful, despotic man who, when that little girl was taken out of the hospital, I took her out to have her teeth. Her teeth were awful, and she was a pretty girl, and she was so embarrassed and ashamed of her teeth that I talked her mother into taking her out to the hospital and having her teeth all pulled, and they were all stitched up. And she came back, and her father was so mad that I had interfered that a week later, he tore all the stitches out of her mouth. Without cutting them, just tore them out.
What in God's name ever became of this woman, do you suppose?
I don't know. I have no idea. She was never appeared in town again. And no one asked, and no one said anything.
No one asked.
There was no cop in town. There was no police there, you know. I mean, you know, and no one wanted the police there. The RCMP, they were 60 miles south. No one wanted
them. Are we calling this No Town? Are we not giving this town a name?
This is No Town, B.C., 1962, up in the interior. Yeah, let's leave it there. There's nothing there anymore anyway. The mill that was there is all torn down and gone. Like all those industrial towns, you know, they were there to rip off the trees. And they really were there for that, you know. This is before Wacky Bennett, you know, basically sold the province out and sold all the small, you know, offered everybody a quota. And then the little mill guys said, oh, wow, great. You know, I can get $1 million for this quota. And they all sold out to four big outfits and they all live in Hawaii. They all went to Hawaii and lived really good lives.
And everybody else
just stood there dead.
I don't know what section of this one we could read. Irene Goodnight.
Mm-hmm.
Which is another of the trapped women syndrome. Don't go swimming, boiling hot. Don't talk to anybody.
There's a woman being beaten up by her.
Everybody's being beaten up.
Yeah, this is horrible. This actually comes from...
It's a great book, Patrick.
This was a woman who lived in our trailer park. She lived down the street, and actually the story is a variation because she killed her baby.
Yes, there's no doubt about that.
She killed her baby, and it was a terrible, terrible thing.
She drowns it.
Yeah, in the story she drowns it. In real life, she didn't. She just neglected. She just locked it in the back of the trailer and didn't feed it and starved to death. But in the story, she drowns the baby, and it's because her life is, there's nothing in it, and she's been without sleep for days and days and days, and her husband beats her up, and finally she's afraid for the baby, and finally what she does is kill it rather than let anything else go on. So,
okay, why don't you read a bit from the how about My Name Is Rhonda, and then
okay, yeah. She's sitting beside a little stream, a little creek in the back of a trailer park, and she's sitting there with her baby in her arms, and she's just talking. And she's gone out there because it's hot as hell in the interior, and her husband's finally asleep, Jim, and she's out there with her baby, and she's gone crazy. My name is Rhonda. Rhonda Berngarten. That's Jim's last name. When we got married, I was proud to take his name. I'm still proud of it. Jim and Rhonda Berngarten and their daughter, Irene. Doesn't that sound nice? That's our trailer over there, the silver one with the blue stripe along the bottom. Jim says he's going to get some paint one day and paint it where it's all flaked off. It's not one of the big ones, but it's nice. It's only got just the one bedroom, but there's a bathroom and a kitchen and a little living room. That's lots for us right now. Irene sleeps in the bathtub. I don't know what we'll do when she gets older. It gets so hot during the day, but it's better than a lot of people have. There's worse traitors than ours, that's for sure. Poor Alice McCassie and that baby of hers. Her traitor was just a little one. There was only one room. Maybe that was the problem, I don't know. But he didn't have to run off like that and leave her with nothing but waiting. I'm glad I didn't have to go in there. I'm glad it was the men who did. I wouldn't have wanted to see that after all those weeks and with it hot. Poor Alice. I watched from the window when they took her away in the truck. And that little baby. They hauled that trailer away. I don't know where. I guess somebody bought it. Jim bought ours with the money Mother left us after she died. It wasn't much, not enough to anywhere near buy it outright. But Jim makes the payments every month. It'll be ours in 5 more years. $2,000. That's a lot of money. I wish my mother had liked Jim a bit more. He isn't mean to me, not really. Jim isn't a mean man. Sometimes he hits me, but I understand. It's working in the mill all day in the sun, and then he gets those terrible headaches. He doesn't beat Irene, though. There's lots of fathers beating their kids. I know a few, some right here in the trailer court. Tommy McCassie did that. And theirs was only a baby, not really a kid at all. I could hear it from our trailer, and Alice crying. Jim never does that. And then it goes on.
And then it goes on. That's from the story Irene Goodnight, from Patrick Lane's new book. Well, geez. Anything funny? Anything funny ever happen up there?
There was an odd gallows humor to the time, to the era. You'd find things to laugh about and things to, you know, things to cry about.
Do you think that you've vented all of this? Vented?
Have I sort of, you know, wiped that stuff out of my... Yeah, it really, it cleared a lot of things out of my life. I think I would like to write some more stories.
Yeah.
But I would like to write about... Oh, I shouldn't say that on the radio because some other writer will be out there.
They'll steal it. Why do you have that big scratch on your forehead, Mr. First Aid?
Oh, that's because I moved to Victoria and we moved into a house that is got a jungle around it, and I was sort of cutting away the jungle because Lorna's from the prairie and she gets up in the morning like Goethe and says, more light, more light. So I'm out there with, you know, machetes and axes chopping away.
Saint.
Yeah, I know. It's amazing.
I know.
It?
Have you got a job over there, you two, or what's the story and why are you in Victoria?
Lorna's got a job. Lorna was offered a
of
job
course.
At the University of Victoria, you know, and so I followed her.
Yeah. Kept man.
I prefer to call it a love slave.
Well, you know, I find it very hard to get back into what you write about and your personality. Whenever I've met you, you're always laughing and screaming and having a great old time, and then you go out and read the poems.
And everybody...
maybe that's why you're able to be such a scream in real life and so depressing in your work. So we should talk about Mortal Remains, because after all...
Yeah.
A big book for you. And I...